So Mr. Sherber?
Ryan Watson, in place of Mr. Sherber today, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm sorry. Mr. Watson, good morning to you.
Good morning.
But let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. That appears to have taken place, so good morning again, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, fellow justices. My name is Ryan Watson. May it please the court, I represent Mr. Maestrick, the appellant in this matter. The primary question before the court is whether Sherber and Wagner's representation of Mrs. Maestrick in a prior workers' compensation harassment claim is substantially related to her action for marital dissolution filed 3 years later, so as to disqualify the firm from representing Mr. Maestrick, the appellant. To clarify, there was a conflict in the briefs between the scope of review. I believe in our brief that we submitted, it noted that the scope of review was essentially the regular scope of review as applied to all dissolutions. I think the appellee scope of review was a little bit more appropriate to the matter, and that the factual determinations are reviewed for clear error. The legal question, specifically this one, whether the matter is substantially related, should be reviewed de novo. We would adopt the appellee scope of review in this matter. Now, we don't believe these matters are substantially related because, one, there's no similarity in legal issues here whatsoever. Two, any overlapping factual issues are readily discoverable. Now, this court said in State Expo Walmart v. Cordham that the matters are substantially related if they are factually and legally similar, so as to pose a genuine threat that confidential privileged information disclosed by one client cannot be used against them in a later action. Nowhere in Appellee's brief do they make an argument that these matters are legally similar. And moving on to the factual similarity, even assuming all the facts by the appellee are true that were set forth in her affidavits, these matters still are not substantially related because those facts which she set forth were readily discoverable by any other counsel that the appellant were to employ. So if we look at Exhibit 2, page 1, I believe it to be paragraph 3, that's where she describes what the harassment claim was based on. And in that affidavit, she states that she admittedly disclosed abuse to coworkers, and harassment was based upon coworkers treating her differently because they were aware of the abuse and upset that she stayed with him. But her purpose for trying to disqualify counsel, and that's stated in Exhibit 1, page 1, paragraph number 3, is that she shared with Sherber and Wagner, in meeting with Mr. Wagner in regards to the workers' compensation case, all of her medical and work harassment history at that time. Some of the injuries, hospitalizations, and work harassment towards me were a result of abuse from Mr. Maestrick. So if we look at the timeline when she first met with Mr. Wagner in 2010 to discuss this workers' compensation case, she admittedly had disclosed the abuse from Mr. Maestrick to coworkers before even meeting with Mr. Wagner. Then in 2013, she files the dissolution action. Mr. Sherber is not counsel at that time. However, in a motion for temporary allowances on March 18, 2013, she submits an affidavit where she goes on to describe in great detail the alleged abuse she suffered by Mr. Maestrick, disclosing it again, those confidences she believes Sherber and Wagner should not use against her. In Exhibit 2, page 1, paragraph number 4, she kind of closes her statement in a little bit about what was disclosed to Mr. Wagner by stating that she did not disclose all the abuse, but that which was seen by the employer. So if we compare this case with State Expo Walmart v. Cordham, we note that it's far different than the factual, the legal similarities in that case and the factual similarities. The legal similarities in Walmart v. Cordham were that the firm had represented Walmart defending the action in a slip and fall case, and then they turned around and represented the plaintiff a couple years later in another premises liability case. Essentially, both of those were negligence actions where Walmart was the defendant. The concern there was whether Walmart had disclosed any practices, policies, or procedures regarding to defending those actions to the firm. And the court noted that those policies that Walmart carried in regards to how they managed their stores were readily discoverable. So even if those were shared, because they were readily discoverable, it undermined any genuine threat that Walmart had to be concerned with in disclosing confidential or privileged information. And that same thing applies here. Because she had disclosed, prior to even meeting with Mr. Wagner, the abuse that she believed she had suffered with Mr. Maestrick, it makes it so, it undermines her entire claim that those confidences should remain with Mr. Wagner. And if the court has no...
You're using that expression differently. They're not confidences, you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. They are not confidences. As she alleges they are, but
okay.
They are not because they have been disclosed.
Your position is they're not confidences.
Correct.
They're out there.
Correct.
Okay.
And furthermore, as the rule was stated in determining whether these matters are substantially related, there's no legal similarity here. And without any legal similarity, I don't think the court can go on and determine that these matters are substantially related. So unless the court were to somehow, were to kind of modify that and say, if the factual relations are so close, it can overcome any disparity in legal similarities, then we have to look at the facts that she's concerned with being disclosed. And those are the abuse she alleges occurred by Mr. Maestring, which she discloses prior to even meeting with Mr. Wagner, after meeting with Mr. Wagner, but before Mr. Sherber gets on board. And then once Mr. Sherber gets on board, alleges that those are confidences she wishes Sherber and Wagner to not use against her.
Does the trial judge here have to err on the side of caution, given the not only this case, but also the image of the legal profession?
Well, I don't believe, and I think it was actually stated in Walmart v. Cordham, that when we're determining whether the matter is substantially related or not, the court doesn't look at whether there's an appearance of impropriety. That's not the determination on whether these matters are substantially related. Now, I can understand why the court may err on the side of caution in that matter, but in doing so, the court balances that with the hardship in obtaining new counsel, the cost and expense of doing so, and the hardship on the court of disqualifying the attorneys that are otherwise eligible to act as counsel for mere potential conflicts that do not pose a genuine threat. And if there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Heavey, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Heavey, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, May Struck. The real question, I think, before the court this morning is whether Judge Arterburn clearly erred in determining that potential confidential information was disclosed by the plaintiff, Mr. Wagner, during the prior case, which could become relevant in this case. I think that it's obvious that in her affidavits, Ms. Maestrup would not have gone into complete detail of everything that transpired. But I think that Judge Arterburn could clearly and correctly determine from the evidence that was presented that there was a substantial risk of confidential factual, not legal. There was no conflict in the legal issues, but there was overlapping factual information that Judge Arterburn could have very correctly concluded could have been or was disclosed. For instance, Mrs. Maestrup wouldn't have wanted to reveal in her affidavit in court if there were extenuating circumstances associated with any of this abuse. There may or may not have been. We don't know that. There's so much potential, though, for overlapping factual information to have been disclosed by Mrs. Maestrup during her conversations with Mr. Wagner that I think the court was clearly correct in making the ruling that it did.
Does it need to be any more precise about confidences without revealing the confidences, but sort of giving a pigeonhole of confidences that were disclosed, which would trigger the protections?
That's always a hard call.
You don't want to reveal it and say I don't want to reveal it.
You don't want to reveal it, but you have to reveal enough to inform the judge that these subjects were discussed, and I think that...
You think the record was adequate?
I believe the record was adequate to indicate to the judge, and the record was adequate to give the judge a sufficient basis to conclude that confidential information was disclosed concerning facts that could become relevant in the in the divorce case. And, you know, this is a case where if there was this kind of abuse and it occurred in the presence of the children and affected the children, as the affidavit of Mrs. Maestruck indicates, then this could have an effect on the child visitation provisions, Mr. Maestruck's response to pleading request, joint custody. These issues were not resolved, and the custody issues and visitation issues were not resolved at this level. And this was pretty much the beginning of the case as far as Mr. Sherber's involvement was concerned. Just as soon as he was involved in the case, Mrs. Maestruck filed her motion to have him disqualified. So it's not a situation where substantial prejudice is going to result from having an attorney dismissed who's had a long involvement in the case, and somebody else is going to have to catch up on everything. Mr. Sherber was in the case, but the evidence indicates that there was a communication of factual information that could be relevant.
At the point when Mr. Sherber entered his appearance, had your client already revealed the confidences, if you will, in the context of the litigation, and she already talked about the potential abuse in pleadings, in filings with the court?
No, there was nothing of that sort. Well, let me say this. There were affidavits that were filed in connection with the motion for temporary allowances, and some of that was discussed at that time.
Are those in our record?
Those are, I don't think they're in the record. I'm not sure. I not believe so. But that's not the end of it, because, you know, the end of it is, what else did she say to Mr. Wagner in her conversations that weren't included in the affidavits? You know, certainly if these conversations occurred, there were questions and answers. There could have been other factors revealed that if recalled by Mr. Wagner at a subsequent date, could have an impact on the outcome of those aspects of the case. And I'm not suggesting that Mr. Wagner was false in his affidavit, but I've known Mr. Wagner for probably 25 years or more, and I suppose that he's had hundreds of thousands of interactions with clients and has probably, like myself, forgotten most of them. But that, in my experience, doesn't prevent a person from subsequently recalling a circumstance or a conversation or an incident with sufficient stimuli, and so that's the risk that exists here.
The risk is the possibility that the lawyer might recall something that hasn't been articulated.
Certainly, Mr. Wagner, when he signed his affidavit, I'm sure, and I suppose Judge Arterburn was sure, that he truthfully said that he doesn't recall any such conversation. That doesn't mean it didn't occur.
Or it doesn't mean he might be refreshed.
It doesn't mean he might not be refreshed. And, you know, most clients have perhaps dozens of interactions with attorneys over the course of their lives, whereas attorneys have thousands and thousands and thousands of interactions with clients. Forget most of them, but you can always, there's always the possibility of those facts being recalled to your mind in some way. And under the circumstances, I think the question is, was Judge Arterburn clearly wrong when he made this determination on this record? And I think on this record, you have to conclude that he was not clearly wrong, that it was an appropriate and correct decision, and that it should be sustained.
What's the standard of review on this, of the court's decision? How do we review the court's decision?
Oh, I think you review it de novo to determine whether there was clear error. And if there was clear error, then you make your own factual determination de novo. If that's all, I'll submit that on my brief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 2 minutes and 36 seconds, Mr. Watts.
Thank you.
I just want to address very briefly that in the motion for disqualification, and it was noted, I believe, received as Exhibit 1, that is an affidavit that's dated March 7th, 2013. And if you go back and look at the record of what was discussed at the hearing on March 18th, 2013, the court states that it has reviewed the affidavits. And so we can only assume that that is, I mean, I think it's easy to assume that that is the affidavit that the court had reviewed. And in that affidavit, she had discussed at length the abuse that she allegedly had suffered. Now, the importance here is that because these matters are not legally similar, it makes it very difficult to assume what confidences she may have conveyed that would be relevant at this dissolution hearing. And if it's strictly the abuse to which she, the potential abuse to which she states, that she's already disclosed to other parties. And that is why I think the court looks to make sure that these matters are legally similar, because otherwise if a client were to meet with an attorney for a bankruptcy matter, how would that affect a personal injury matter, 5-6 years down the road? They have to kind of specify what they believe those issues that were discussed during that representation, what those issues are and how that may overlap.
But she's concerned about how an allegation or claim of abuse might play out in a dissolution with regard to some of the subsidiary issues, right?
Correct.
Custody or visitation and things of that nature. So she may have an interest in not expanding it or perhaps expanding it.
Well, that's sort of correct, but it works to her advantage. And she used, and that's why she has disclosed it to the court, in the dissolution action, she's using the alleged domestic violence to her advantage to show that the best interest of the children is that she were to have custody. Whereas in the workers' compensation harassment case, maybe disclosing that she had been injured in some other light would pose a disadvantage. That's why I think we require some legal overlap between the issues. Because the factual overlap...
How do you see that substantially similar? Not just form of action. Or is that your position?
Well, I think that you have to have some similarity in what purposes the facts serve. If they can serve for an advantage for a client in one action and a disadvantage in another action, then it undermines the genuine concern that those will be disclosed, that confidential information will be disclosed. So if there's no more questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.